We have nationalist Russia. We have theocratic Iran. We have Bolivarian socialist Venezuela. None of them want to have checks and balances or transparency or the rule of law. And they're also united in their dislike of us. And us is you and me and probably everyone listening to this podcast. Anybody who wants to live or who thinks it's important to live in a state that does have checks and balances, that is a liberal democracy where people do have rights.
Hey everybody, welcome to the Michael Steele podcast. Yes, you've landed at the right spot, and I love it when you do. You can listen to us on Apple Podcasts, iHeartRadio. Love dancing with our friends over at iHeart, Spotify, wherever you get your podcasts. This podcast is part of the Bulwark Network, and I've been having fun at the Bulwark and enjoying my friends over there. I hope you're enjoying us as well. You can find them on social media at Bulwark Online, and you can enjoy this episode. Please, like it, share it, fall in love with it, right? Because that's what we try to do. I'm excited for this episode. I'm really happy to welcome to the mic Ann Applebaum, who spent 17 years as a columnist at the Washington Post, becoming a staff writer at The Atlantic in 2020. She is the author of 5 critically award-winning books, including Twilight of Democracy, Between East and West, and Gulag, and which was the winner of the Pulitzer Prize. She is quite the jet setter, if you will. She divides her time between Poland, where her husband is a foreign minister, and Washington, D.C. She joins us in, I think, a very important conversation around her new book, Autocracy, Inc., The Dictators Who Want to Run the World. And we get into what this new landscape, not just globally, but here in the U.S., really looks like. What are some of its underpinnings? And why it's important that we pay attention to what's happening to our democracy and the control that we still have as we the people. Ann Applebaum and her new book, Autocracy, Inc., coming up here on the Michael Steele podcast next.
Drivers who switch and save with Progressive could save hundreds. With that kind of money, you could go big time on a fancy water bottle
with ultra titanium alloy metal.
You're not sure why you need all that. I mean, it just holds water.
But you're getting it anyway, because if you're hiking near an active volcano and you accidentally drop the bottle into molten lava, your water will still be icy cold. Switch to Progressive and you could save big time for water bottles. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and affiliates, not available in all states. Potential savings will vary. Drivers who switch and save with Progressive could save hundreds. With that kind of money, you could go big time on a fancy water bottle
with ultra titanium alloy metal.
You're not sure why you need all that. I mean, it just holds water.
But you're getting it anyway, because if you're hiking near an active volcano and you accidentally drop the bottle into molten lava, your water will still be icy cold. Switch to Progressive and you could save big time for water bottles. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and affiliates, not available in all states. Potential savings will vary.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to the Michael Steele podcast. Well, I've been looking forward to this conversation for a while. I am a huge fan of Ann Applebaum's. I love everything she's written. Her work is profoundly important at this time. And so I'm just really, it's a special treat for me to have Ann on the podcast. Welcome.
Thank you. I'm really happy to be here. I'm an admirer of you. So
I appreciate that. Look, girl, you just lay down the tracks, as we like to say. You it's like, okay, here, this is how it is. This is what you need to know. And you've got your new book, Autocracy, Inc., The Dictators Who Want to Run the World. And you lay it very bare for us into what this moment looks like. And what we're seeing happening, not just here in the U.S., but globally, and what that says about the world order of things. Before we get into some of the specifics in the book, I do want to get your sort of broad assessment of this landscape. And what were some of the early triggers for you that told you, oh, hell, this is about to get real stupid real fast if people don't pay attention?
So I should explain maybe to begin with that the book describes a network. It's not an alliance, you know, or an axis even. It's a group of countries who don't share anything ideologically, not in the way we used to think of it. So that right. We have communist China, we have nationalist Russia, we have theocratic Iran, we have Bolivarian socialist Venezuela. You know, we have all these different kinds of countries who aren't some with no real historical links even, who are now united by a set of common interests. So they don't act together all the time, but there are a few things that they share. These are all absolute dictatorships. None of them want to have checks and balances or transparency or the rule of law. All of them are aware that they have dissident movements or oppositions who do use that language, mm-hmm. and they want to push back against that. And they're also united in their dislike of us, and us is you and me and probably everyone listening to this podcast. Anybody who wants to live or who thinks it's important to live in a state that does have checks and balances, that is a liberal democracy where people do have rights, and they see that kind of civilization as a threat to their own. This was not always true, but it has become true in the last decade. And you can really pinpoint a couple of moments. I mean, I suppose the Iranian Revolution was in 1979, and they've been pretty clear about their intention to create a theocracy, a religious-based regime ever since. Russia and China, you can date a change from about 2013, 2014. 2013 is when Xi Jinping starts his rise to power. And it's about that time the Chinese Communist Party publishes a wonderfully named document. And the document is called Document Number 9.
In case you were curious,
it's document number before 9. And it lists the perils facing the Chinese Communist Party. And number one on the list is Western constitutional democracy. And by that, you know, and then of course on the other rest of the list, you know, freedom of speech and free press and so on. And by that they mean that that idea is a challenge to their form of absolute power and their form of control. And they can't tolerate it or any discussion of it in China. And increasingly they see that they need to push back against it around the world. And you have a similar moment in Russia in 2014 when you had if you remember the Ukrainian Revolution of that year, when the Ukrainians threw out a would-be dictator, a leader who was pushing them in the direction of autocracy. They pushed him out with a street revolution where they were talking about anti-corruption, the rule of law, joining the European Union, democracy, and so on. And that language and that movement frightened Putin, because that is exactly what he's afraid of in Russia. And whenever he saw people using that language in Russia, he pushed back against them. And eventually, I mean, the most important political leader in Russia, Alexei Navalny, was what he ran was an anti-corruption movement.
Right.
And then of course the two of them, you know, and Iran and others also began to see that they began to understand their part of pushing back against those ideas was that they needed to help their fellow dictators. And so you see this phenomenon of them rescuing Nicolas Maduro in Venezuela, for example, or helping out the dictator of Belarus. And so the book starts with that premise. It tries to explain what that is, how it happened, a little bit of the history of how we got there, and how it's making the world different. I mean, you can see it in the war in Ukraine. You know, this is not just Russia's war in Ukraine. Russia has drones from Iran. It has ammunition from North Korea. It has trade with China. It's getting components for its defense industry from the Chinese. And so you see that there is a kind of authoritarian network working together with them in that war. And in a way, that war really is it's the current kinetic front line in that clash. Although I think it's a clash that's taking place all the time in all kinds of places, right. Mostly not militarily.
Let's start with some basics, because this is something that intrigues me, and even through a lot of your writing, which I follow quite a lot, I still come back to a fundamental question, and I think a lot of people may have it, is why do people, civilizations, allow themselves to be subjugated that way? If in any given society you said to them, okay, here's a choice. You can be and do and whatever you want and live your life however you want. Or you can take one person and have them dictate the terms in which you will live your life and limit your freedoms, your ability to associate, ration your food, and you choose, I'll take that. I'll take plan B. What have you learned in all of your study and writing in this space about the human aspect of this, that people at the end of the day, on one side of their mouths, say they yearn for freedom, but then so quickly go, all right, well, I'll just give the power to this one asshole and let him dictate the terms. And I'll be pissed about it in about 6 years, but right now I'm good. And we see that here in the US with MAGA, with Trump saying, I want to be a dictator. And people, yeah, sign me up. We need a dictator in this country. I'm like, dude, do you know what that even means? And so is it a lack of understanding what these terms actually are? We throw around fascism and socialism and communism in this country like, as candy. And no, I guarantee you the people who are throwing those terms around have no frigging clue, not only what they mean, but the historical nexus of those words. Help a brother out, because I don't, am I missing something here? Because I'm like, I'll take plan A. I want to be free and the government's limited, and I don't need one person telling me how to live my life.
So it's a great question. Actually, my previous book was all about why people in democracies become attracted to the idea of dictatorship. But let me start by reminding you that most civilizations through almost all of human history were what we would now call autocratic. So they were monarchies, or they were dictatorships, or they were oligarchies, or they were run by an elite or by a single party. And that's how most of humanity has always lived. So the exception, the extraordinary and unusual civilization is ours. And by ours, I don't mean the United States. I mean the US and the democratic world. So that's US and Europe and the Asian democracies and Australia and the democracies of Africa and Latin America. The nations that have that are the unusual ones. And historically, most democracies have eventually failed. They failed spectacularly in the 1930s. South American democracies failed earlier than that. And many countries have been through cycles of democracy and dictatorship. In some ways, the question should be asked the other way around. How is it that we have what we have and have managed to preserve it, and why don't we value it more? But I think, the modern autocrats, to really oversimplify here, because of course this depends from country to country and there are a lot of nuances, but modern autocrats do now use a kind of a familiar set of arguments, and they use them in Russia, and you can hear them in Venezuela, and you can hear them in the United States. And those are arguments usually about stability. We offer you security, safety, and stability. And in some cases, they pin onto that some kind of traditional social hierarchies, maybe, patriarchy or some form of hierarchy that people recognize, as opposed to democracy, which is divided, chaotic, degenerate, and sometimes they even mean sexually degenerate. And that language does have resonance with people, and it is a kind of language that I think has a lot of resonance with people when we're living in moments of very rapid change. And this is one of those moments. We're living in a time of rapid economic change, demographic change, social change, even moral change. And of course, above all, change in the way that we get and process information. This, you know, the shift from the real world to the online world has been pretty profound, even if we don't always recognize that. And for a lot of people, it's very disorienting. And I think that's the impulse that leads people to say, you know, it's just too noisy out there. I can't stand all these contradictory arguments. There are too many different kinds of people. I want one thing. You know, and I want to.
But isn't that just being lazy? I mean, at the end of the day, you give up that quickly? I mean,
I'm not an advocate. I'm not even playing devil's advocate.
Oh, I know you're not. I know you're not.
I'm trying to explain it. You know, I spent a lot of time trying to understand it. But I think for a lot of people, you know, the noise of, particularly of polarization, you know, this kind of loud clash of ideas makes people feel, you know, somehow, you know, they can't stand it and they need like some single message. And you know, in the autocratic world, the language that is used, for example, you know, if you live in Russia, you hear all the time about how Europe is degenerate and dying and divided, and, you know, the state takes your children away, and, you know, people are murdered every day on the street by immigrants. And I mean, that's what you hear if you're watching television. And some of that same kind of language is also echoed and repeated, you know, in the US and Europe. And people are also told, you know, there's this terrible chaos. I mean, maybe it's not right here outside your door, you can't see it.
Right.
But look, here's a picture of a terrible murder that happened somewhere, you know, and this is what's going to happen to you unless you support our right-wing movement, whether it's Vox in Spain or whether it's Marine Le Pen in France or whether it's Donald Trump in the United States. And that language works on people. And I agree. I mean, as I said, I've spent a lot of time trying to understand it and reading people who, both the people who create that kind of language and the people who follow it or are convinced by it. And, you know, it's just as hard for me to understand as you, but I think as people who want democracies to survive, it's worth trying to understand it because somehow we need to persuade those people that they can have safety and security inside liberal democracy as well.
Well, but the dirty little secret in my view, Anne, is that those totalitarian regimes are just as degenerate.
Of course.
I mean, whether it's sexual deviance or corruption or anything else. But they
my book is very much about corruption. I mean, another thing that modern dictatorships all have in common, which, by the way, makes them different from a lot of the dictators of the 20th century, is these are billionaires. You know, they are.
Right.
Putin is one of the richest men in the world.
That's because they stole the wealth. I mean, it's
they
not
stole
like
their,
Putin
they
had
stole
a job
the wealth
and
from
earned
their
that
people.
Money.
They stole it, and here's a really important point. They stole it, and with the help of the international financial system created by the United States and its partners, they stole the wealth, they laundered it, they turned it into anonymously owned property in London or in Italy, and they, in some cases, took it back again. I mean, there has been this massive amount of theft that has gone on in the last couple of decades, and some of it was enabled by Western bankers, you know, lawyers, accountants, and so on. But yeah, no, these are profoundly corrupt regimes, and they are. I mean, the idea, you know, there's the idea that Russia is somehow a religious country. I mean, I've seen statistics. I mean, something like 5% of Russians have ever read a Bible. Very few people go to church. You know, it's certainly not a Christian country in the way that it's sometimes portrayed. I mean, there's a large Muslim minority, and including there's a part of Russia, Chechnya, which is run partially by Sharia law. I mean, it's a very, very harsh and ugly, ugly system, you know, so it resembles, it's nothing like, it's not some kind of traditionalist marriage paradise, you know, far from it. It's a very poor, very corrupt and declining state. I mean, it's, you know, living standards are going down, you know, so the idea that it would be some kind of idol or ideal for American conservatives is really insane. Nevertheless, people have been convinced.
They have been. And I just think they're stupid. I just keep it real from the street perspective. I look at that and I go, why are you allowing yourselves to get punked like this, knowing what, and in full measure, people know what's at stake at the end of the day, which goes back to when they're making that choice. And you in the book, keyed in early on, in the chapter, I believe it was, let me go pull it. Let me see. It was controlling the narrative. And you talk about, quote, a few autocracies still portray themselves to their citizens as model states. The North Koreans famously hold vast military parades with elaborate gymnastics displays and huge portraits of their leader, very much in the Stalinist style. But many of the propagandists of Autocracy Inc. have learned from the mistakes of the 20th century. And it is in that regard, and you touched on this just a moment ago, how do the modern day autocrats differ from their 20th century predecessors? What did they learn to do better and improve upon in a negative way to lock their power in?
They don't, certainly Russia doesn't portray itself as an ideal state. So the Soviet Union was, you know, had described a kind of socialist paradise towards which we are all going. And Soviet propaganda was all about how great the Soviet Union is and how many bales of hay we're producing and how many tractors we have. And you remember the social realist art with these kind of, you know, muscly, you know, factory workers and women in dungarees, and they were working towards socialist paradise. The Russians don't talk like that anymore. Instead, their propaganda has different functions. One of them I've already mentioned, which is to portray the democratic world as divided and decaying and, you know, and undermine it so that people don't want that. Another point of propaganda is to keep people out of politics. And so this, we're also familiar with in this country, the phenomenon of repetitive lying, you know, lying over and over and over again in ways that are completely improbable. You know, the famous example is when the Malaysian airliner was hit in Eastern Ukraine, this back in 2014, and it had been struck by a Russian missile. And the Russian state came up with literally dozens of explanations. You know, there was a plane full of dead bodies and it was exploded on purpose, or, you know, it was hit by the Ukrainians. I mean, there were all kinds of crazy stories. And the point of that was for people to say, oh my gosh, this is so confusing. I have no idea what happened and I will never know. And
right.
I will never find out. And by making the truth seem something impossible and unknowable, and confusing, you know, then you persuade people, right, we're staying out of politics. We don't want anything to do with it. We're removing ourselves. We're going to be apathetic, you know, and that's what happens in Russia. People don't participate. People ask me all the time, you know, what do the Russians think about Putin? I mean, the answer is they don't think about him. You know, they don't think about, well, maybe we could have Putin or maybe we could have something else, because they don't see an alternative. They only see him. They don't see any other system. They don't see a mechanism to replace him. They're not really sure what's true about him and what's not, because there are so many different stories and so many lies have been told over and over again, some of which they know are lies. Their attitude is, keep us out of politics. We don't want anything to do with it. We're staying home. And that is what they want. They want apathy. They want disengagement. They want people to stay home, essentially.
Is there a fine line between what you've just described, that apathy, and the Navalny's of the world who want to engage to use a strong term, overthrow the dictatorial precepts and designs of particular rulers, the oligarchs, et cetera, who clearly have a very self-interest in all of this, and using the sort of that apathy of the people against them in a way that, you know, Navalny looks like the bad guy for actually wanting to bring freedom to his fellow Russians.
So Navalny was very brilliant, and one of the things he understood was the need. He really did try to create a movement, because he also believed that engaging people in the process, bringing people, giving them things to do, creating a building civic engagement from the ground up, building sources of trust and other alternative sources of information, that this was how you would get change. You know, you weren't going to get anything overnight. And that's actually, if you look at, for example, the Venezuelan opposition, it's very similar idea, you know, that we need to create civic engagement. We need people involved in the election campaign, even though in their case, it was very dangerous. You know, we just had an election in Venezuela where the opposition absolutely clearly won, and they produced right. all the receipts and so on to show that they won. And how did they win? Partly was because they'd been running this program of engaging people in public life for a long time, even though, I mean, in the case of Venezuela, people were discouraged by violence, by literally food rationing. I mean, the state would ration food, and if you didn't obey, you could lose your food ration. And so it was that's what happens in a state when you have very extreme shortages like they do in Venezuela. All these, you know, or whether any movement you look at, whether it's the Iranian Women's Movement or the Hong Kong Democracy Movement, these were all movements of people who believed in engagement. And engagement is the opposite of this kind of autocratic system. And it's just as true in democracies. You know, the most dangerous thing for a democracy is a democracy where politics have become humdrum, boring, and sort of the province of just professionals. And right. that was actually happened in the US. You know, there was this, where Joan Didion once wrote a brilliant article about, she was covering, I don't remember now which US election, and she wrote about how politics had become this kind of specialized branch of journalism that only special political journalists did, and how odd that was in a way, because politics should be something that people feel they can engage in at any level, whether it's your neighborhood or your mm-hmm. you know, your community or your, you know, whether you're in a political party or whether you help out in polling or whether, I mean, it's something where, you know, democracy works in the United States as anywhere else when people are engaged.
Yeah, it's required. I mean, that's to make it work. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's very, very dangerous for democracy for people to become alienated or bored or convinced that it's inevitable. So another thing that happened, I think, in the US is that after years of success, really, and particularly after 1989, when the Soviet Union collapsed and it seemed like, you know, we won and, you know, the liberal democracy was triumphant, people said, well, you know, it's going to be all fine. I don't really have to be engaged in public life. I can go on and, I don't know, paint paintings or build buildings or make money. I can go and do my thing. And I don't really have to worry about democracy because that's going to be something that this little group of specialists will do over there. And they're going to worry about it. And maybe I'll show up and vote every 4 years, or maybe I won't. And that's their problem. And that was a mistake, because actually there is nothing inevitable about democracy. I mean, we started by talking about how rare democracies right. are, and how right. often they fall apart, and how many times historically they've fallen apart. And so the sense of inevitability, I don't have to do anything, it's only for specialists, this is really, this can be very dangerous. And this is, of course, what often the autocratic language and narrative tries to do. It tries to push people out. It tries to make them, it tries to make them apathetic and nihilistic and cynical, you know, to take away their belief that politics can be constructive or that it can achieve things. And it's, you know, and once you do that, then you you're paving the way for a different kind of political system.
Yeah, it's a very interesting point, because the one aspect I think that Americans have lost sight of, and I think it's largely due to how we have in large measure disregarded civic education, which ultimately feeds civic involvement, because you have to have an appreciation of what it is you're being asked to be involved in. Why the founders believed what they believed. Why did Franklin, Benjamin Franklin, respond when asked what had just happened in that room where it happened? And he says, well, we've created a republic if you can keep it, you know? And if you can keep it part is the important part, because it requires a level of work that I think a lot of Americans over time have grown numb to.
And of course the irony is that the people who are writing the Constitution were very conscious of how democracies can fail. Yeah. And the reason why is, you know, they were reading the histories of ancient Greece and especially Rome, the fall of the Roman Republic. And they were aware that, you know, rise of Caesar, rise of a demagogue can destroy the Republic. And a lot of the way the US Constitution is written, including some of its weirder aspects, were intended to prevent that from happening. That's what the Electoral College was for, even though it never really functioned that way. The Electoral College was not created so that, you know, Michigan, Pennsylvania, and Wisconsin would decide the US presidential election. That was not the purpose of it. But it was meant to be a kind of break on the popular vote so that, you know, in case there was a demagogue, there would be an interference. Anyway, it doesn't matter. It never has worked the way it was supposed to work.
I was always intrigued by the fact that they use the papal conclave as the model for these anti-papists were like, yeah, let's try that model. This is kind of weird. So you note in the book as well, a very interesting feature of all of this. You write that autocracies keep track of one another's defeats and victories, timing their own moves to create maximum chaos. For example, in the autumn of 2023, both the European Union and the U.S. Congress found themselves unable to send aid to Ukraine because minorities with deep Russian ties, led respectively by Viktor Orban in Hungary and by a handful of MAGA Republicans in Congress, many acting under the instruction of Donald Trump, blocked the majority and delayed the aid. A narrative promoting Ukraine fatigue spread across the internet, pushed by Russian proxies and Chinese media in multiple languages. So almost as a reinforcing point to your earlier point about how these narratives are elevated and pushed out and controlled, you then also begin to see the effects of that on important public policy, particularly with respect to the global order of things, the stability within NATO, the efforts to undermine by Trump and others, the NATO alliance, and sort of locking in the course chosen by the Viktor Orbans and the Vladimir Putins, et cetera. Talk a little bit about how these autocracies kind of play off of each other, mimic each other to some extent, make a chess move, and the other's like, okay, I'll make a counter move, not so much against that move, but to distract and create another area of angina for the West.
Yeah, no, so certainly they do something which is relatively new, which is they, as you were just saying, they coordinate narratives. So they, it didn't used to be the case that China, by the way, has a massive international media network, TV, radio, websites, content sharing agreements with lots of newspapers, you know, and other media organizations around the world. They didn't used to share narratives as explicitly as they do now. So now I give an example in the book of a story at the very beginning of the Russian-Ukrainian war, the Russian invasion. The Russians put out this weird story about how the US was building bio labs, so biological weapons laboratories in Ukraine, and that was somehow responsible for the war. Completely fake story, not true at all. Nevertheless, it was repeated by the Chinese media, by the Russian media, by the Venezuelan media, by the Iranian media, and also by a part of the American far right, who also, Tucker Carlson picked it up, and a few random people on the internet began pushing it as well. So, so they have this, and it's, I should say, coordinated doesn't mean that there's like a guy in a room who gives orders. You know, they simply copy, they right. imitate one another, and they look at what one another is doing, and then they follow the same thing. So I don't necessarily think, it's all about, maybe there's some money exchange in some cases, I'm sure there is, but a lot of times it's not, it's just imitation. And they also support one another in various ways. So Orban is a very weird case. I mean, he is a democratically elected leader. He was absolutely very popular at the beginning of his second term, the second time he was elected. But as a democratically elected leader, he began to take apart the institutions of the state. So he began to take apart the media, not by censorship, but by using, the threats, business people who advertise in independent media might have had trouble dealing with the state. It was a slow process of judges, media, intermediaries, taking over the civil service, step by step, putting his political party in charge of pretty much everything, culture, universities, and so on. And once he'd done that, he began to have friction with other European countries and with NATO and with the United States. And so then he began looking for other allies, and Russia was delighted to step in and to be his ally. And Russians were delighted to step in and do these opaque investments in Hungary, where money is invested into nuclear power plants and with the contracts all kept secret, and when nobody really knows where the money went or who got it. And that's one, you know, those kinds of arrangements, see that kind of secrecy, that lack of transparency, that corrupt relationships are part of what can help keep Orban propped up, even as he, as I said, began to come into conflict with his former allies. And he's, you know, he's sort of sought to create a sort of alternative, you know, alternative network. I mean, he's one [S2] Right. [S1] Of these figures who's partly in the Autocracy Inc. network and partly in the democratic world. There are a few other examples like that.
So that begs an important question. So when Viktor Orban gets to his second term, popularly elected, democratically elected, does it occur to him, A, I want to keep this power, or B, was that his objective all along?
I've known him at different times, and he did change. I can't tell you what was the moment when he changed, but, you know, even people around him, some of his original allies melted away or, you know, turned against him and so on. So he made a transition from being a kind of liberal leader, you know, to being a center right leader, to being a far right leader, which he's now a far right autocratic populist, who seeks to control every form of communication in his country, and who also controls the economy of the country via a group of oligarchs who are close to him. In some cases, they're members of his family. And at what moment he decided to create that system, I can't tell you, but it's a pattern that we've seen elsewhere. And by the way, it doesn't have to be a right-wing leader who does this. I mean, that's Venezuela, the Hugo Chavez, who was the leader of Venezuela before he died and was replaced by the current leader, Nicolas Maduro. He did the same thing. You know, he was using a different language. He was talking about, kind of Latin American socialism. But it was the same effect, was to take over institutions of the state and make sure that he would never lose. And when you see people beginning to do that, you know, this is when alarm bells should go off. And of course, this is why this weird affinity between Trump and some of the people around Trump and Orban, you know, is so peculiar and so dangerous, because Orban is someone who consciously and knowingly tried to take apart his democracy and has then allied himself with the autocratic world, with the foreign dictators, in order to help him keep that corrupt, you know, one-party state in power. And if that's the model that the Heritage Foundation or mm-hmm. Project 2025 or others around Trump want for the United States, then if Trump wins, we would be dealing with a disaster of a kind that I don't think we've ever dealt with before.
I'm enjoying my conversation. I hope you are as well, with Anne Applebaum. She's the author of the new book, Autocracy Inc., the dictators who want to run the world. We're going to take a quick break, and when we come back, we're going to domesticate this conversation of authorities that want to take control of our lives and talk a little MAGA and Trump and what that may look like in 2025 should Trump get his way. More with Anne Applebaum right after this.
Drivers who switch and save with Progressive could save hundreds. With that kind of money, you could go
big time
on a fancy water bottle
with ultra titanium alloy metal.
You're not sure why you need all that. I mean, it just holds water.
But you're getting it anyway, because if you're hiking near an active volcano and you accidentally drop the bottle into molten lava, your water will still be icy cold. Switch to Progressive and you could save big time for water bottles. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and affiliates, not available in all states. Potential savings will vary. Drivers who switch and save with Progressive could save hundreds. With that kind of money, you could go
big time
on a fancy water bottle
with ultra titanium alloy metal.
You're not sure why you need all that. I mean, it just holds water.
But you're getting it anyway, because if you're hiking near an active volcano and you accidentally drop the bottle into molten lava, your water will still be icy cold. Switch to Progressive and you could save
big time
for water bottles.
Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and affiliates, not available in all states. Potential savings will vary.
Welcome back, everybody, to Michael Steele Podcast. So for this part of the conversation, folks, you may need to get a bourbon. I'm just saying straight up, you know, I got recovered. So just settle in because it's about to get real exciting. And it's always, when I watch you on various programs, and certainly when you're on our air at MSNBC, what I appreciate about this moment now is that we've had a chance to sort of expand and sort of really kind of get a firmer understanding of what this sort of global elevation of authoritarian power is like, and what it looks like, how it comes about. And we see it now here at home with Donald Trump running for president, claiming straight up, hey, make me a dictator. I'm ready to do this. You know, we'll do it for one day, you know, tongue firmly planted in cheek. Talk a little bit about how, what you see, what elements and aspects of what we've just talked about globally with the Viktor Orbans and the Putins and others who are clearly models for Trump in so many ways. How do we see some of that playing out here in the U.S.? It's not just in the manifesto of Project 2025, which is the blueprint for the deconstruction of our administrative state, our government, you know, transfixing it and putting in place their sycophants and acolytes to Donald Trump. But it's a little bit more than that. Talk a little bit about, if you can, how MAGA and what we see happening here in the U.S. fits within Autocracy Inc.
So you're right that there are people around Trump, and one has to be careful because there are a lot of people around Trump, and they want a lot of things. Right. It's very hard to know who would actually be in charge and what would happen. So here we're talking about one particular aspect of it. You know, there are clearly people around Trump who admire what Orbán did, and in that sense admire what Putin did, and admire the ways in which he took over the Hungarian state with his political party and his people. And by the way, I lived through a very similar phenomenon in Poland, which is actually where I am now. We had, for 8 years, we had a ruling party which tried to do the same thing. They did it less successfully, and they ultimately lost an election. But it was very similar. You know, it was pressure on the media from different sides, financial pressure of different kinds. It was pressure on the courts. They tried to change the court system and the way that it works. And you know, in the U.S., you can see there are all kinds of institutions that operate. It's not even according to laws, but according to norms. Mm-hmm. I mean, if you look at the military, you know, and of course, I mean, everybody who's in the military now will disagree with me saying this, but if Trump decided to, or someone else, or President Vance, you know, or some other some future president, wanted to transform the military by getting rid of a top layer of generals and putting in different kind of generals who were loyal, not to the Constitution, but to him personally, or to his party personally, and were willing to, for example, participate in domestic crises, or were willing to act on the president's, you know, to act more as an internal security force, which, you know, the U.S. Army, absolutely, it's verboten now. I mean, it's very rare, occasional moments when, you know, but, you know, in our history, but it's not at all normal. But some of that is, you know, there's, you know, the guardrails against the corruption of the army are norms and education and feelings rather than legal systems. I mean, if you were really determined to change the way the army works and you put a different kind of leaders in charge, you would begin to get a very different kind of institution. And you can imagine that with a lot of institutions. I mean, the army is a particularly, it would be a particularly controversial, but I don't know, the FDA, you know, the Food and Drug Administration. Right. Instead of having it run by scientists who are testing drugs to see whether they cure you of cancer or not, you could put people in charge of it who want to make sure that forms of, you know, medicated abortion are illegal. You know, you could change the nature of what some of these state institutions do. And then you could begin to eventually have a very different kind of state. Or, for example, you know, there's a lot of federal funding that goes to universities, for example, for research, right, for big scientific projects. Or, you know, if you wanted to use that money and say, okay, we're only going to give you this money if you agree to change the way you teach in a particular way, or we're outlawing, I don't know, women's studies programs, or we're changing
Black history programs.
Or we're changing
We've already
black
begun
history.
To see that. Yeah.
Right. And so, and you can see some of that at the state level. You can see it in Florida, for example. And you can begin to see the state beginning to use, you know, because we're used to thinking of universities as being independent of the state, having their own governing systems. You know, tenure is supposed to protect academic freedom. But there are ways, if you were, you know, if you were vindictive and if you were, if you thought about it, that you could use. It's not about legal changes. It would be about using money, using influence to change the way education works, or, you know, in the country and so on. And that is, you know, those are very real threats. I mean, there are people around Trump who talk about it, and they have speculated about it out loud, and they talk about it on podcasts, and they wrote it up. Some of it is in this famous Heritage Foundation report, and some of it we've seen already at the state level or at the local level, these fights about school boards and so on. And so all of that is, and these, the ideas of doing that aren't coming from nowhere. They're borrowed from the autocratic world, or the illiberal world, you know, the world of leaders like Orban or like Erdogan in Turkey, or even like Chavez in Venezuela, who were democratically elected and then proceeded to take apart their political systems. And, you know, it's, of course, it's imaginable in the United States. I mean, here, you know, it's true that in the U.S. we have a federal system. You know, it's a lot bigger country than Hungary.
Right.
You know, there would be all kinds of resistance. I mean, I'm not saying it would succeed necessarily. But, you know, even if it didn't succeed, you could do a lot of damage by trying. You know, you could.
Yeah. And I take your initial point, you know, that some of the military may not agree with what you said. But we've already witnessed the chipping away of that when you have the chairman of the Joint Chiefs don his uniform to march with the president across Lafayette Park.
Yeah, to be fair, he says he didn't know that was gonna what was gonna happen.
I'll give you 3% of that. You know, I look, as my mama say, you're a grown ass man. You don't know why you're putting your uniform on, and the president's gonna walk out the building. And you at that
he,
point,
General Milley behaved well later on, but he did.
I'm giving you all of that, but I'm saying we already have an example where Trump has manipulated. Mm-hmm. That relationship between the civilian leadership and the military to co-opt it to do something that political. Many of us found problematic in that moment. And I get all of the other, you know, Milley came forward and said what he said, and he, you know, did the right thing later on. But my point is, to your point, how easily manipulated that can be for even people who think the military would be less susceptible to that. My argument is it would not, particularly given Anne, and I think you may have in some of your writings at least noted this, but I know other writers have who are tracking and following this, that right now within our nation's police departments, within our National Guard, within our military, we have a growing faction of MAGA heads, individuals who would put their allegiance and their loyalty in one person, Donald Trump, as opposed to honoring the oath that they took to hold those positions. So in this environment, you can't tell me that this nation isn't susceptible to that particular failing in our democratic norms and ideas, because we're already beginning to see efforts that chip away at that.
Yeah, no, I mean, and you could go institution by institution, and you could, if you were trying to corrupt the system, you could do it. I mean, you can think of, you would find ways to, if you, I mean, think about the process of judicial appointments. I mean, the kinds of people you appoint to, to the federal bench, have a huge effect on the law. And here, I don't even just mean conservatives or liberals. What if you begin to appoint people who are specifically loyal to the president, or specifically loyal to Donald Trump, whether conservative or liberal,
Right. Well,
originalist
that
or
fades away. This is not a conservative liberal conversation we're
No,
having in the world at
I'm
this
not even
point.
talking about the normal things we argue
Right,
about conservative.
exactly.
I'm talking about what if you, we have this case of the of a judge in Florida who has who seems to be protecting Donald Trump from the from the it's a case,
Accountability that comes
it's the
by the rule of
documents case,
law.
right?
Right.
So there's a case, he took these documents out of the White House and he lied about them to the FBI and so on, and she's delayed and delayed and delayed and delayed in order to prevent that case from coming forward. I mean, it looks like she's directly protecting him, and that's not a right wing or a left wing or a conservative or a liberal or an originalist or whatever kind of legal theory. That's just someone who's protecting Trump. And what I would start to worry about is those kinds of people being appointed to the federal bench rather than, and all down the line, when you look at, it's the kinds of people you appoint and with what aims. Again, I lived through a version of this in Poland where, where a lot of the state was taken over. I mean, it was literally by people's cousins, somebody
Right.
who was loyal to the party or somebody who was
You mean
somebody's family.
Pookie got
That's
a
right. It was that was how it was decided. And there was an effect of it. I mean, the in Poland they have state companies, and these state companies were became these cash cows for their their money, which is supposed to be taxpayers' money, was going instead directly into the ruling party's coffers. And people are now, right now, there's a lot of that is being investigated, and people are being arrested. But you could imagine a version of that in the United States as well. It's not that hard to imagine. And I'm sure, versions of it have happened in the United
Right,
States at the state
right.
level. I've been working for the last few months on a podcast that'll be out in September, where we have an episode where we talk about Huey Long, who was the governor of Louisiana, and who actually wanted to be president of the United States, but who essentially did that. I mean, he did a form of state capture in Louisiana, and he, took over these various institutions and made them work for him. And that's a, it's happened before. And a lot of our state governments are pretty weak now, and a lot of state legislatures are, the districting at the this is at the state house level is often so polarized that
Right.
a lot of people who win elections in Congress without a and sometimes over and over again, I mean, not sorry, not Congress, but to state
State
legislatures,
legislature, yeah.
who win elections without having an opponent, for year after year after year, because it's not worth running as a Democrat in some red county in Tennessee. And so, you begin to have people in politics who, are they really there to work for the voters, or are they there to work for themselves or to their donors? And, it begins to be a big problem.
So as I let you get back to working on that podcast, which we look forward to coming up. What's it going to be named?
It's called Autocracy in America.
Okay. All right. All right.
After the, it's a, the famous Tocqueville book is Democracy in
Yeah. No, that's good. We look forward to that. And let us know. We'll definitely want to promote it on our platform here as well. So a two-parter for you as we wind down. The first is, given everything that you know and have tracked and have written about, what concerns you about a Trump second term in light of particularly Autocracy Inc.? And what specific strategies would be the part B of this? Do you think or suggest democracies, specifically us here at home right now, having about to go through an election process where we already know, Anne, that there's going to be a whole lot of BS on the back end from MAGA and Trump if Trump loses. this thing about the election being stolen. We're all being set up for that lie right now. So what specific strategies do you suggest that democracies like ours take, adopt to combat this sort of new form of autocracy that you very, very clearly and I think in a very helpful way discuss and outline in your book?
So, you know, take a lesson from the Venezuelans, you know.
There it is. Yeah.
People should, you know, be engaged in your local elections. You know, we need, decent citizens working in, at polling stations. I mean, it's a little late for this, but, you know, making sure that your election officials are real election officials, right, and are not
that
there
would help.
In order to steal the election. I mean, pay attention. I mean, especially if you live in a state where, where the election could be stolen, or where there are officials around who, you know, we need citizens groups who monitor the election or who monitor their officials. Be aware in advance of what's going to happen. Be ready to protest, contribute to the legal groups, you know, who are getting ready to defend the electoral process in case it needs defending. You're a citizen, it's your country. You can take responsibility for it. You could be part of this process too. I can't tell you how important it is that lots of people are involved. That's the only way we counter it.
All right, there it is. Smart stuff. And given everything that we know already that Trump has told us that he wants to do, it is important and sobering to really appreciate how much control we have over what happens next. And it does involve a lot of what you just outlined, Anne, in terms of civic engagement, citizens taking responsibility for what tomorrow looks like. I get it, you know, gas prices and food prices and all these things that we want to make excuse for wanting to give power away that our Constitution gives to us. But the consequence of that could be deadly for democracy as we know it. And you've written, as you always have, an expert book that really gets us into that part of the conversation that sometimes can be a little bit uncomfortable, and people just don't want to have to really think about that aspect of their responsibilities and allow autocracies to grow up around them. So I appreciate you taking time and coming on and having a conversation with us. The new book, Autocracy, Inc., The Dictators Who Want to Run the World, is out now. Pick up a copy and enjoy it and share it. I'd love it when I get to see you on the air. I love your writing in The Atlantic. I didn't even get to the piece you wrote back in June. I pulled it up because I wanted to reference it, the new propaganda war that you wrote about.
It's partly from the book, so it's partly from the
book, so that's why I said, oh, we kind of covered it, but again, if you want to get a taste of what Anne is thinking about and how she's seeing the dynamics around that are happening around us, absolutely check out her books, Twilight of Democracy, Between East and West, Gulag, and her writings for The Atlantic, and the new podcast, which will be coming up in September, Autocracy in America, right? So we're excited for you. And follow Anne on Twitter. I refuse to call it X, at Anne Applebaum, look for her again for writings at The Atlantic, and her book is out now. So thank you again, Anne. Appreciate you.
Thank you. I appreciate it. Great
Absolutely.
Conversation.
Well, folks, that does it for our time together. It is blown by, as it always does when you have a great guest who walks us through the conversation. And I do appreciate Anne coming on. If you love what you heard, you know what to do. That voodoo that you do so well, do the download thing, share and like. Definitely, check us out on iHeart and Apple Podcasts and spend a little time with us. We try to make it interesting and have some fun at the same time. Until next time, hey, I hear summer's winding down. So y'all better get working on that tan. I think I'm a little ahead of the game. Come on, catch up. All right, everybody, take care until next time. God bless.